This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
When Branka and Jojo remembered this day for the rest of their lives, it was not for the unseasonable weather, although the anomaly of spring visiting a week before Thanksgiving certainly made it memorable. It was much too warm and bright for November in New York. It felt almost as if it were May with its luminous and dazzling sunshine and gentle breeze. People cheerfully threw off their coats and breathed in this gift of nature. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I'm talking to Meryl Ain about her newest novel, The Shadows We Carry. Fraternal twins Branka and Jojo Lubinsky were born in a DP camp after the end of World War II. So they are original boomer babies, but they're also second-generation Holocaust survivors. Their father's first wife and child were murdered by Nazis, and their mother was a Christian woman who saved his life. They married, and she never converted, but raised Branka and Jojo to follow her scrupulously observant Judaism. The twins are navigating young adulthood. Jojo deals with an unexpected pregnancy, and Branka dreams of becoming a serious journalist. Learning about a Nazi community in nearby Long Island with a main street named after Hitler rattles Branka and propels this story about growing up in post-war America, Jewish-Christian relations, finding communities, 1960s upheaval, and how every generation is weighed down by the shadows of family and history. Hi, Meryl. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Galit. It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you come to write a continuation of the lives of characters from your first novel?
Well, I guess there are two reasons. The reason that I like to give the most is that my readers asked me, they wanted to know what happened to the twin sisters after the book ended. And honestly, some of them felt like I kept them hanging. The other answer is that my husband, who's a journalist, is my muse. And I showed him every chapter after I wrote it, and he weighed in on it. And when I showed him the chapter that became the last chapter, he said, "This is the end of the book." And I said, "No, it's not. I have a lot more to say on the topic." And he said, "Trust me, this is the end of the book." And, you know, Galit, I've been working so hard on it. I guess I said, fine, I'm happy for the book to end, but I always felt I had much more to say.
Got it. Jojo and Branka and their parents live with their father's parents, and those parents.
Cousins.
And they winter in Florida and keep an eye on their schizophrenic daughter, the girls. They call her Aunt Becky. That was a difficult time for mental health. Not that we fixed the problem in 2023, but back then, even worse. How does Aunt Becky's situation figure into the story?
Well, she's more of a character in The Takeaway Men. And she figures into it as another person with a secret, basically. Her mother, Faye, keeps this as a secret. But I mean, the girls know and the family knows that there is something not quite right about Becky. And Becky can be a loving, generous person. She buys the girls their first Ginny dolls. But, you know, when she has her schizophrenic episodes, it's very difficult. So, it was writing about people with secrets and people who were marginalized. And that was my rationale for having Becky in this story.
And another marginalized character was Ned. Branka has this longtime crush on him. Yeah. She hopes to marry him. All the other adults realize, and the reader realizes that something's off, but Branka doesn't get it. It's all still very secretive back then. Can you say more?
Well, it was very secretive back then. I mean, we're talking, this story really begins, there's a prologue, with the Kennedy assassination in 63, but the story really begins in 1969. And I believe that was the year of the Stonewall riot, where, that was the first time that there was really attention paid to the whole question that there were homosexuals living among us. So it was very typical in those times to hide your sexual identity. I mean, we've gotten very used to now, people are out in the open and they marry and they have families, but it wasn't like that. Then it was a big secret. And, if someone was suspected of being gay, there were certain epithets hurled at them. And we were really living in a very intolerant time. So, many people hid their identity from their families and friends. Many did carry on a secret life. I mean, it was not unusual for a person who was gay to get married or be in a heterosexual relationship at that time. So it was a very different time.
And there are some people who'd like us to go back to that time, but right. Your story really is, there are a lot of secrets here. One of Branka's colleagues at the newspaper, Brian, mentions that during World War II, his father fought on the Russian front and didn't know anything about the concentration camps. So I remember being in Austria in the early 80s, and we were speaking German, and everyone we spoke to claimed to have fought on the Eastern Front. Mm-hmm. They weren't that old back then. It didn't make any sense. So how did you research that story?
Well, I have to say that I have been researching this topic, it seems, for most of my life. When I was fascinated with the topic of the Holocaust ever since I read The Diary of Anne Frank. I'm a former history teacher. I did a lot of research on former Nazis. It's mentioned in passing. Well, the former Nazi is in the Takeaway Men, but what is mentioned in the Takeaway Men is the fact that the United States government really looked the other way after the war. The whole focus after the war was on hunting down communists. And it's just mind-boggling to me that people really didn't care that Nazis were led into the country. And there were some rather famous Nazis who entered the country and worked in the space program in it. Los Alamos. I mean, everybody knows the name Wernher von Braun, and there were others as well. The whole focus became on fighting communists. It changed, and I researched that it changed. In the late 70s, where Elizabeth Holtzman created this, the Office of Special Investigations under the Department of Justice, and Nazis, former Nazis, were really hunted down, and some were brought to justice. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there are films, books, papers, lots of things about it now. Mm-hmm.
I recently interviewed the author of The Shadow of Dora, a novel that explores the space program's path from the Dora Mittelbau concentration camp in 1940s Nazi Germany to the Apollo 11 moon landing in 1969.
Wow.
Fascinating. But Branka, your character Branka, is shocked to learn that there are Nazis in America. We were all shocked in the 70s.
Well, yeah, I think so. And especially that there was a German community on Eastern Long Island, which before the war actually had a Nazi youth camp where they attempted to acculturate American youngsters into Nazi values. But the street names in that community were named after Nazis, of course. And this is true. I call it Fatherland Gardens in the book, but it's the name of it is actually German Gardens. It exists. The main street was Hitlerstrasse. They were named after Nazis. And interestingly, until 2017, that's 6 years ago, you had to prove not a German lineage to live there. And then that was, outlawed by New York State.
Okay, better late than never. Branka asks, can you ever escape your family's history? That's the crux of the book, isn't it? What's your answer?
Yes. What is my answer?
Yeah.
I raise that, for readers to think about. I think your family's history is your history, and it is certainly part of you. But I don't think you necessarily need to allow it, as in the case of Brian. I mean, he just felt devastated and destroyed by the fact that his father had been a Nazi, a guard who ushered Jews into the gas chamber. There's a physician in Florida who was on the speaking circuit for a while, and his father was a Nazi, and he's turned that into speaking to groups of students about the dangers of the Holocaust. I in the case of children of Holocaust survivors, there've been studies really that there is something there, I don't want to, whether it's genetic or whatever, that sense is with you. But the reason that I created twins was that I wanted to show that although all children of Holocaust survivors are impacted by their parents' background, their reactions can be very different.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. After Brian finds the stash of Nazi memorabilia belonging to his father, he and Branka bring in Father Stan, a Catholic priest. Can you say a bit about that?
Well, Father Stan is also a person who has an unusual family background. He's a Catholic priest. He's a rising star in the diocese, and he loves the church. He's loved the church ever since he was a little boy. He loves the sights and smells and sounds of the church, and he's a very devout Catholic. On his mother's adopted mother's, Beth the deathbed, he finds out that he was adopted by the family he always knew as his parent, and that he had been given to them when he was a month old. His parents were Jewish, and they gave him to this family for safekeeping, and they perished in the Holocaust. And he, you know, was brought up Catholic. So he, when he finds out that he is biologically or genetically Jewish, he starts to explore his Jewish roots as well.
That was fascinating, that part of it. Branka, who asks the questions we all have, asks this one. She says, if the children and grandchildren of Nazis and their sympathizers bear any responsibility for what their relatives did during the war, what's your answer?
That's a good question. That's why I had her ask it, and I wanted readers to ponder it. I don't believe in inherited guilt. I do not believe that. But I do believe that we all have a responsibility to try to make the world better. And that is one of the things that I find very upsetting about this time period, which I've studied extensively, is that, you know, you not only the Germans, not only most Poles, and, you know, there were about 11,000 who were righteous Gentiles, but there were many more who weren't. And I don't know I just finished watching A Small Light, the story of Miep Gies, who kept the Anne Frank and her family in hiding. It was on, I think it's on Netflix. So there were certainly people who stepped up to the plate, but you know what? They're really few and far between. And even we have to think about, you know, what did the United States do? You know, the whole rationale was, well, we're going to win the war. We're going to win the war. And everything is geared to winning the war. And in the meantime, you know, 6 million Jews and 5 million others perished at the hands of the Nazis. So to me, you know, a better way to look at it, or better, is, you know, what is our individual responsibility, and what do we do when we see evil in the world?
Yeah. Branka and Jojo's father says two things worth talking about. One, there's a solution for every problem. And second, he says, the next generation, just like ours, we'll have to learn to live with the shadows we all carry. Can you say more?
Well, I do think that there is a solution to every problem, and most problems, most personal problems. And sometimes the solution is just, you know, that you can't think about it or dwell on it all the time, or allow it to ruin your life. I do think, though, that we all, you know, we all have our shadows, we all have our burdens, we all you know, I said to my kids, you know, parents are just a generation older than their kids. So, you know, why are parents expected to know everything? So I think that, you know, there are solutions. They may not be elegant solutions. It may be, I can't think about this anymore. I have to put this to the side and concentrate on something else. And we have to learn to live with those shadows. I think that is absolutely true.
Yeah. You reference the author Helen Epstein wrote in 1977, and I remember reading it.
Really?
Yeah. Many didn't survive, but my mother had a large number of cousins who survived Auschwitz because they were young and because the Nazis didn't get to Hungary until 1944.
Right. So, but they did a job once they got there.
Yes, yes. So many of us are connected. Many of us in this in our generation, can you say more about how that article changed everyone's views at the time?
Yeah, I mean, what seems obvious to us now was just a stroke of genius on the part of Helen Epstein. She identified the group of children of Holocaust survivors as an entity with certain issues and concerns. And it, you know, I should say, I haven't said this, I'm not the child of Holocaust survivors. I both my parents were in the U.S. Army in World War II, but we've known many survivors, and I have many friends who are children of survivors. And what they've told me and what I researched was that Helen's piece was like a breath of fresh air. It was an aha moment for
them.
Yeah,
it was a wake up call.
Yeah, they knew what they weren't alone in what they had been feeling. And what happened was, I mean, there are now many second generation groups. There are third generation groups of the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. And shortly after that, it seems that the United States, anyway, started paying more attention to the issue. There was, which I mentioned in the book, the series on NBC, the mini series called Holocaust, where it was, you know, brought to the general audience. And then, of course, you know, there was the creation of the OSI. Steven Spielberg, you know, created his Shoah Foundation and got testimonies from the survivors. And then we had the Holocaust Museum, created in D.C. and many more throughout the country. So it you know, prior to this, the word Holocaust was not really used that much, nor was the word survivor. After the war in the 50s, some people referred to it as the Shoah, which, as you know, is Hebrew for the Holocaust. But there wasn't even the word survivor. They were called refugees or greeners. So even the language changed after Helen's article.
Yeah. So Meryl, what are you working on next?
Well, right now I'm trying to get the word out about Shadows We Carry, and that is very, very time consuming. But I started doing some research. As I mentioned, my mother was a WAC in World War II, and she wrote a memoir which was never published. And I'm looking through the memoir. I'd like to, fictionalize that. And I'm actually meeting with a friend tomorrow who's going to share some of her mother's papers with me. Her mother was an Army nurse who was part of the team that went into Dachau after liberation. So I see what I can cook up from wow. Want to tell the story of these women, but I haven't released. I'm just in the research phase.
Okay, thank you so much again for talking to me today. It's just been a pleasure, Meryl, and I wish you the
best. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you for joining me. This is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking to Meryl Ain about her novel, The Shadows We Carry. Hope you all have a juicy book to cuddle up with tonight and always. Happy reading, everyone.